Welcome to Perfect Bound. I'm Jennifer Yaffe, the founder and publisher of Yaffe Press in Atlanta, Georgia. This is a podcast where we talk to artists about their journey, how they got where they are, what right and wrong turns they made along the way, and where they're heading next. Alan Rapp is editorial director at Monticelli, a division of Faden. He's an editor, book developer, and writer specializing in photography, architecture, and design. He started his visual book publishing career at Chronicle Books, where he developed the photography list and published books by Eleanor Carucci, David Mizell, Jonna Frank, Jim Marshall, Linda Connor, Henry Hornstein, and others. Under the Monticelli umbrella, he's collaborated on new works by Eleanor Carucci, her book Midlife, and Jonna Frank, Cherry Hill, as well as Sig Harvey's fourth book, Blue Violet. He's contributed to several books, and his writing has appeared in numerous print and web publications, including the Photo Book Review, Modern Painters, and Urban Omnibus. Please welcome my friend, Alan Rapp, to the podcast. Okay, so you want to get started? Are you ready?
Yes.
So, you started your love affair with books and with publishing as a bookseller and then a publicity assistant. So, can you talk a little bit about how you transitioned into editing art books? Because I think that's really interesting that you started on one side of it and kind of got into the more creative aspect over time.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I went to school in Los Angeles, Loyola Marymount, and that is partway through college, but back into high school, I was a bookseller. And, you know, I was just really taken with what this company in San Francisco, Chronicle Books, was doing. I was very familiar with them by the time I moved to San Francisco after college. And not knowing almost anything about publishing, I decided to apply and thought, you know, that's where the editors go and that's what you do. Really having no idea about any of the other dimensions. I mean, you know, like every film that has someone in publishing, they're an editor. So I had, you know, it's
right.
Like, or Elaine from Seinfeld, or, you know, it's just yeah. Like, that's all there is.
right.
There were no positions open, and there was a publicity assistant position open. And I, you know, learned a little bit about that as I was applying, and it started actually making a lot of sense because I was still going to be, you know, an interesting interface with authors at a time when their books are really already developed and, you know, ready to sort of present in the marketplace and to the media. And so it was this really interesting bridge of, you know, kind of positioning and managing perceptions of just, you know, what these books are and what a project is.
Right. Kind of like branding in a way.
Yeah, completely. And, you know, the basics, like writing press releases, which itself is a pretty, you know, daunting exercise, but a good skill to learn. And then, you know, following up with media people as you're, you know, sending them books, pitching them books. And at the same time, you know, I was an English major. And so I was interested in writing and started doing freelance writing for like some of the music magazines and some of the counterculture magazines like Boing Boing when it was still a print zine. And, you know, started hanging out with interesting people in the Bay Area who would become the kind of like, not even the first wave. By the time I got there, it was maybe like a second or third wave of this sort of like technological utopians and the founding editors of Wired magazine and that kind of thing. So
that's awesome.
I was at the same time just trying to stay creative, you know, thinking like my work is this one thing and yes, I'm writing, but it's, you know, I'm trying to keep my creative side over here and a bit of a sustained freelance practice. And so I wrote on and off for those years. And at the same time, I was just encountering people and projects that seemed like, I mean, you know, by the time, after a few years, I really understood the sensibility of Chronicle. And I started encountering, you know, some people and ideas that seemed like they could be adapted to books and started referring them to some editors at Chronicle, some mentors of mine, like Annie Barrows, who was managing part of the photography list in the 90s. And, you know, there still was a kind of interesting, substantial photography list in Chronicle and other trade publishers at the time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Joel Sternfeld, Sally Gall, Andrea Modica, like those were some of the photographers that were being published by Chronicle. And so some of these projects that I was referring over actually started getting picked up. And, you know, I realized that maybe I did have that kind of editorial sensibility. Mm-hmm. And when Annie left, it seemed like maybe a good position for me to transition over to editorial. Mm-hmm. And in a kind of interesting way, in that I was not starting kind of conventionally, like as an editorial assistant or like an intern. I was, a little bit beyond that, having already understood by then how the company works and what the list really is and where to go. So I didn't start as an assistant, but at the same time, I didn't really have a mentor. So I was kind of like thrown into this.
Winging it.
Yeah, totally winging it. Made a lot of mistakes. But started, kind of cultivating an interesting little list of my own that when it started getting into photography, I mean, some of these were inherited or referred over projects. Someone like the late, great Jim Marshall would not have been in my cohort at that time.
Yeah. You were an English major and how did you connect with photography and photographers, like from the writing aspect to the visual?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, part of it was that the bookselling job that I had in Los Angeles, or Santa Monica more proper, was Hennessy and Ingalls, which is great art design architecture bookstore, and it was then on the Third Street Promenade, the sort of flagship store. And that was my introduction to the world of visual books, and so I was kind of just getting into everything at that time. It was also a new arrangement in the early 90s that Fiden was getting distributed by Chronicle Books in the US. And so there was this new kind of like bigger world at Chronicle of, this prestige, although kind of like, reinventing itself at the time, art publisher. And so it was kind of, getting closer to those books as well. And over the term of the last few decades, the irony being that now Monticelli, where I'm editorial director, is owned by Fiden. So there's kind of like a long arc there.
Full circle,
But it was a kind of, interest of mine on the side. I didn't really have training for it. But that is, school training, but then just working at such a, uniquely visual publisher like Chronicle was itself like my,
on the job. Right.
Yeah.
Of all the photo books you worked with during your time at Chronicle, what can you tell us about a couple of your favorite experiences and what made them so meaningful to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Some of these are with artists who I have continued to work with over the years. So interesting details there. I got to know Eleanor Carucci when she was developing her first body of work and was shopping around, came into Chronicle as she was on a trip to San Francisco and, really, presented this at the time, very daring, very bold, but also just, so personal and so intimate and kind of, really personally accessible even for me as a, as man, but with the kind of, universal access to these, glimpses at these familial relationships, love partner relationships. And it was just, incredibly striking. And for me, kind of a new generation was sort of, in her work was presenting itself. And Eleanor just you know, and I really hit it off.
Yeah. Has there ever been a more lovely human being than Eleanor Carucci?
No.
I've never heard anyone do anything other than gush about how wonderful she is, with good reason.
Absolutely.
She is amazing and just, and so open and accessible as a artist, as a person.
Very generous, a great friend, but also, you know, there's, it's no surprise that she is like an incredibly inspiring teacher. She inspires incredible loyalty to, you know, from her students and just, you know, people who work with her. And I think there's just, you know, something to be said. I mean, it's so tricky when it gets into art and you're talking about, you know, the truth of photography and that kind of, you know, is there, you know, can you even establish a sort of baseline of sort of philosophical truth in photography? I would argue no. And yet we, you know, I keep coming back to work that is this representation of real life that is, you know, feels, if it's not true, it's at least honest, if that
makes sense. Yes, 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 yes.
And I think Eleanor's work was helping, you know, articulate those kind of, you know, huge philosophical ideas, really, in a way that I could personally interpret them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it just was a really great kind of development. And, you know, in down to, she loves collaborating on the level of the edit and the sequence. And we, you know, I learned a lot just through that process.
Mm-hmm.
And so we debuted Closer, as the body of work was published as, in, I believe, 1999. And I'm forgetting, I'm not always great with memory and dates, but I think that's the case. And it, you know, really kind of did its own thing. It made its own impression in the photography book world at the time. And so, you know, I was very proud to be able to bring
everyone that was like, that Alan Rapp is a genius.
then, you know, just one backstory detail there is that I presented it and it was not immediately picked up. You know, I think it was perceived, rightly so, as like, this is kind of bold. There's a lot of nudity in this book. There's nudity on, you know, I mean, ultimately there's nudity on the cover. But, you know, it did make an impression, and it did not, you know, we didn't immediately pick it up. After a year, Eleanor came back and was further developing the work. And there was just a lot of evidence. I mean, you know, it was partly in the publishing, you know, scheme, you have to present not just the value of the artist in terms of the art is great, but just, you know, the position, how will it stay in the market? And, you know, commercially, she was also getting interesting projects and, you know, was represented. There was just more evidence that this is a young artist who is going to be going somewhere. And I thought of this as, we have the opportunity to publish the first book by this artist. And that's a distinction that never goes away. There's always, you know, the first book is always with a certain publisher. And so, you know, we could be part of that. And I think after a year, it actually just made more sense to people. And I think that, you know, maybe there was just a little bit of a, you know, early seeding that kind of ultimately flowered. But that helped, I think, create a certain sensibility for more photography books at Chronicle that could do certain things. And it was, even if the subsequent projects were really nothing like it, you know, the other books that I went on to make with, like, David Maisel, his Library of Dust project, which is, you know, an incredibly striking and hard to encapsulate project of portraits of copper canisters that had human cremated remains from patients who were interred at a Portland, Oregon Psychological Hospital and had been sort of, you know, no next of kin to pick up these remains. And so they had been cremated and kept in a vault or a room in these canisters for decades. And it started becoming public that there was this, a scandal, really, that, you know, there were these conditions at the hospital. And David accessed the hospital and made this very moving, very provocative body of work of just these canisters themselves, which had over time been subjected to water, humidity, and were kind of like efflorescing like batteries when they go bad. And so it's again, hard to encapsulate.
Yes.
And you know, think, pity the poor young editor who's about to present this project to an editorial board. And our editorial director.
The person having to write the press release.
Yeah, yeah. And the editorial director, I think, asked if I was trying to spiritually test her. It was a great response. But, you know, again, there was this kind of idea of making a book out of some, you know, ineffable project that, someone with real dedication and vision was putting together. And so that was, that kind of, you know, books like that helped me develop this sensibility of the kinds of books that I would still continue to want to do today and sometimes have opportunities to.
Yeah. And it's really fortunate that, you know, both David and Eleanor had you as a advocate, because again, it's the quick read would be, this is too much, too hard, too challenging, potentially.
Potentially. I mean, again, as this, you know, the market transition that was sort of a, you know, slow burn also in terms of, did visual trade publishers really want to keep doing those kinds of photography books if they're, you know, hard to package, hard to sell, complicated to make, expensive to produce, higher price point, specialized audience, like all these things that are sort of counter to, you know, larger scale trade publishing wisdom, right?
And yeah, absolutely. Well, it's counter to all wisdom, actually.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
All logic and reason.
And so, yeah, think of yourself as a publisher and thinking, you know, all of the constraints and, you know, all the opportunities too, but you have to kind of have a certain, you know, dedicated method to justify going in these directions, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So kind of to that point a little bit, you've seen the publishing industry change a lot during your time working in it. So what changes have you seen for the better and what have you seen for the worse?
I mean, this is also not a novel factor, and, you know, we deal with it in the artists that we, you know and are friendly with and talk to and work with all the time. But the kind of, you know, real viability in the rise of self-publishing is something that I think is, it's still, even though it's not new, it still kind of feels new in a way. And artists are doing, continue to kind of like do different things with it in terms of, you know, not hewing to conventions or formats or, you know, and going in pretty interesting directions. But
it's like, it's not new, but it's becoming more and more validated and kind of the rules are getting more broken, I guess, for lack of a better, you know, like there's the boundaries are getting pushed in a very exciting and acceptable way.
Absolutely. And then, you know, but the thing that is tricky about that is just the atomization within the market of, you know, how can you, again, you know, with our attention spans shot as they are, for so many reasons these days, you know, how do you keep on top of some of this? And where do you go, especially, I mean, you know, pandemic is obviously a factor in all things, but, you know, what are the ways in which we can encounter this work, that especially if, you know, you don't live for example, in a city with an annual art book fair or that kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
So I think those are some of the changes that are amazing, and just the, you know, access and availability to printing and publishing technologies and platforms is great as well. But, you know, there again, the downside is that there's something to be said for the kind of like, you know, classical model, the traditional model of artists who are publishing through publishers with an editor or collaborating to a degree, even collaborating with a designer who knows their way around, you know, production and, mm-hmm. and publishing and packaging. So there's not always the kind of grounding for artists to know just, you know, how to begin, what to do, and maybe that's pretty cool, like just DIY and punk rock, and that can result in really interesting projects too. But, you know, there again, you see sometimes someone who could use a partner or a guidance on, you know, what it is to edit and sequence and what the conventions and history of the conventions are in books and why certain things are the way they are, which themselves, you know, are, you know, not superfluous often. So I think I mentioned to you, I had done some workshops with some artists that I was working with, like David and like Eleanor and Sig Harvey and Jen Davis on these collaborations between an editor and an artist, because I thought that would be a kind of valuable workshop where people don't always hear from the publishing side.
You know? Right. More from the designer.
Yeah.
If anything. Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of photography pedagogy is taught by other photographers, and that is mm-hmm. also valuable when those photographers have publishing experience. But, you know, I was just kind of inserting myself in the photographer's realm as a kind of, you know, there are some other things you might benefit from learning. And those were, you know, those were always really valuable for me too. It was getting exposed to interesting and some amazing photographers, and just, you know, learning a lot through the exposure to more work in that context. So I always love those.
Yeah. I'm sure it was super helpful. What do you feel like you brought to the table in that situation? Like, what are some of the things that a photographer might not, or, you know, someone looking to publish their work might not know that would be helpful to hear from the publishing side?
I mean, just in some cases, a little bit more of prompting students or these photographers to get into the conventions a little more and ask themselves what is going on. And, you know, it's a really basic exercise. I mean, we have our favorite books. We have our favorite photography books. Can you explain what exactly it is about this book that is, you know, making it one of your favorites? And
right. What's working
for you? And some of that is kind of, you know, people not seeing immediately, which is, you know, itself a function of good design, is like design that you don't totally notice. But sometimes it's a kind of function of the graphic design or production elements, or just, you know, just seeing a very basic but really, you know, tight sequence and relationships, inner relationships between images, and thinking in terms of a book spread to, you know, two pages, even if it's a single image.
Right.
You know, thinking of like different units, like the spread is the way you see a book as opposed to the page. You know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, really kind of not to say this negatively, but some kind of, you know, really remedial stuff in a way that is just a grounding in a process of seeing books as their own kind of genre, you know, and mm-hmm. In a way kind of like as their own technology, and just looking at the different factors that you can kind of, you know, and sliders that create different effects within that technology.
So is someone getting murdered out there?
No, I'm sorry. It's just Wednesday.
New York.
It's Wednesday.
What is happening? Do you need to take cover?
No. I barely hear it. So I'm so sorry. It's probably like mega amplified on your system.
No, I lived in Boston after college, and my last apartment was right on Mass Ave. And the first couple of weeks, like, my roommates and I could not sleep. I mean, it just, the stuff that would happen in the middle of the night. And by the end, like, there were like cars on fire outside and, you know, explosions, and like slept through the whole thing. So I can appreciate that.
Yeah, no, it's adaptation. One of my least lovely apartments in college was in the flight path of LAX.
Brutal.
You know, it's crazy how fast you can just start thinking of that as normal. I would be on the phone with someone and they were like, what the hell was that? And
like, you know. You're like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
So apologies. So what have you seen for the worse in terms of the publishing industry? Like changes that have made it more challenging, either from a publisher's perspective or from the artist's perspective, or both?
Oh, it's, you know, it's a good question. There was the transition of overall fewer photography books being published with trade publishers who had numerous categories, you know, so, and, you know, not to like live back in the 90s or something, but the landscape was that, you know, Abrams and Chronicle and Little Brown and, you know, there were a number of publishers who were Knopf even, you know, who had interesting sort of active photography lists. And I think over time they just were not emphasized. I understand it. All the pressures that you and I just, you know, kind of recounted meant that those lists just shrunk and, you know, the rest of the lists got as commercial as possible. For better or worse, again, I totally understand in market terms. I'm not trying to be a snob about that. But, you know, it's really a good thing that the rise of, you know, self-publishing and, you know, and platforms did arise when they did, because there was a real kind of vacuum going on.
Right. Well, and also like small independent presses, but then they have another flip side of where, you know, if you have a large publisher like Chronicle, where they can make up maybe a financial deficit in the photography department in another area, a small independent photo book publisher, this is it. That's, and a lot of the photographers are bearing the weight of, you know, the financial risk.
That's right.
In that.
Yeah. I mean, and that was a kind of, you know, once upon a time, I think all authors, including photographers, expected advances, for example. Mm-hmm. And, you know, really,
that's adorable.
I know, right? And that's really flipped over the years, over the decades. And so, you know, you've got this kind of self-subsidizing. It's not, you know, there's a model built in there where, yes, it makes sense to offset production costs and all that. And, you know, it is hard on photographers to be able to bear that burden.
Or
make it that they are established enough that they have gallery representation or partnerships where, you know, some of those books or significant, you know, portion of those print runs is actually accounted for through a purchase or buyback. So it is, you know, it's forced photographers, well, to get more savvy on that stuff necessarily. But, you know, they have to bear a lot of the, you know, they need more skills in order to bear all that, really. And funding is always a question. It's always tricky when you're talking about money. And, you know, some of the artists that I've worked with consistently, or, you know, at least several times over the years, like, including, you know, Joan O'Frank, who's a really interesting hybrid sort of, you know, photographic memoir. We published late last year.
Yeah, it's so great. It's such a fun book.
Thank you. Yeah, that's just for the value of, you know, the audience's sake. It's called Henry Hill, A Childhood Reimagined. And you know, to be able to pull off a book that has a lot of intensive production and a high page count too, which is not right. You know, some of these projects just don't belong in a sense, because the production factors kind of outweigh what an individual can do in a sort of self-publishing context, right? So,
sure.
There's still this, I think, valuable role for publishers, even more, you know, art and design, architecture oriented publishers like Monticelli. But anyway, you know, the larger arc that I think I was just describing is a kind of, you know, retrenching of the multi-category trade publishers, and, you know, pushing art and photography books into more specialized art and photography publishers, right? Or self-publishing. And so that has been the big kind of, like, you know, landscape shift. And maybe, you know, there's always the rise of, I mean, again, I've been doing publishing so long. It's like, do you remember when the big retail panic was the rise of the big box stores and the rise of the indies, right?
Yeah.
And now, like, big box stores are not even, you know, compared to Amazon, which really accounts for almost a half of the books that any given title that we will sell, the biggest customer is Amazon, right?
I know. It's
so it's, you notice that.
Yes, I do.
And
I know the $4 per book I get from them when one sells too.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and setting, being the mega, you know, they set the absolute terms that everyone,
yeah,
from the big publishers to the small ones, has to just go along with. So it is just a monopolized market now. And it's still great that you can get photography books somehow, right?
Yeah, I mean, somehow, I mean, it's interesting because, so these bigger publishers kind of lost their photo section, but all these small independent ones have come up, and they're more likely to publish lesser known artists because they don't, you know, I do sometimes print runs of 300.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a lot less risk involved. And so in a way, I mean, the shift has, it makes no sense financially, and it kind of never has. And yet there are more photo books being published than ever.
Yeah.
Because there's just a bunch of psychos like me.
Exactly.
Let's do it. We'll figure it out later.
Yeah. And that's so, I mean, but that's so valuable, as you know, I mean, you know, obviously, like, you yourself would understand that what you're doing has that kind of justification, but it is really valuable that there's just small, active hotspots of publishing, because it makes a difference.
Yeah. What kind of photography books would you like to see more of out in the world?
You know, so, on the personal level, I have weirder tastes than what I am, you know, necessarily overseeing in a kind of editorial publishing role. Like, I like pictures of, you know, static objects, and there's something about that kind of contemplation of the world around us that somehow just is more mysterious and interesting to me than kind of like conventional portraiture, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Oh my God, you know, like your book on When You Leave, All the Plants Will Die.
Uh-huh.
Love it. So good, right? So that's a, you know, but what I want to see more out there, I mean, I've been thinking about this in the context of just, obviously, because it's, you know, sometimes in the back of my mind, and now just more and more in the front of your mind, like just all the emergencies that we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. And looking at some artists who are dealing with, I mean, it's, you know, it's not like aesthetically satisfying to, you know, in a sense, like look at art that is dealing with these sort of climate, political, social emergencies, but we're, you know, you got to look at it. And so, you know, I've been thinking about some of the artists who in their own ways are making really interesting, sometimes very conceptual, but, you know, important work about climate change. And wondering in some senses, you know, sometimes these are hard to adapt to book form. And so I don't totally know how to do it or anything, but, you know, there's a Bozeman, Montana photographer, Ian Van Coller, who, who, I mean, just beyond really amazing field work and, you know, working on kind of like the dissipating glaciers around the world. But there's this really interesting kind of multimedia project where he teams with scientists and, you know, writes over and sort of data analyzes over his photographs. And it's called, I think it's the Archive of the Long Now. And it's a, you know, that's a project that is just so interesting to me and so multidimensional. And I think, you know, can help people think a little less literally about just, you know, the climate panic that we're all feeling, actually needs a pretty sophisticated kind of aesthetic evolution. Right. And so been thinking a bit in those terms. And just, yeah, I mean, you know, working with artists who have, are, you know, analyzing the, you know, interesting avenues of representation of self and social, and their social position. So, I'm trying to pay attention to that. And I think that these are such quickly evolving fields that I'm realizing I have a lot of kind of like catching up to do. So that's part of it. Yeah. I mean, in your position, I kind of, you know, I have a similar question for you when it comes to, I mean, you make your own publishing decisions too.
I do. Yeah. It's not such a harsh committee I have to go up against.
Yeah. But, you know, how do you factor in these like massive changes that are all around us?
In terms of which books I am choosing to publish, or how do I feel about the whole industry?
Yeah. I mean, just, you know, in the sense of how, what is a publisher's role or responsibility sometimes in, you know, it's hard to paint with such a broad brush, kind of like, you know, saying something as kind of sweeping, but also vague as like social equity. But, you know, when it comes to what we can do as sort of, you know, allies or partners in artists, you know, how do you see a role sometimes when it comes to that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I feel like I started in publishing because I was working with so many photographers when I owned my gallery, and then like through the nonprofit and workshops and things like that had really wonderful projects and were paying an exorbitant amount of money to certain publishers to get them published in a way that I felt was taking advantage of the artists. Mm-hmm. And that sucks. So, you know, in a similar way with the gallery, I was trying to figure out ways to help artists just kind of level the playing field so that, you know, the good work rises to the top, not just the people that have $50,000 to pay a publisher to publish the work. And so, but again, the challenge is the financials suck, you know? So like, how can you elevate great work and try to put that financial piece to the side is just a constant it's a constant struggle. And I think, you know, fortunately with crowdfunding has been a great avenue for people, and doesn't have, in my opinion, the stigma that it maybe did in the beginning. It's kind of like, it's a way to pre-order the book and help make it happen. And it also kind of validates that there is an audience for it, that there's enough people that are interested in buying it to warrant the production of it. And I think, so just being creative, and for me, I've had a challenge all along in how, like, what metric I'm going to use to decide what books to make. Mm-hmm. And I kind of had this epiphany recently, because normally I'm like, there are a couple of things that I'm looking at. One is, do I really love this artist, like, as a person? Because you're going to be partnering with them for well over a year. They're going to be a very active person in your life and texting you at 10 o'clock on a Saturday night. Yeah. And you have to enjoy this human. So I always say, like, I have a no asshole rule, which, you know, life, at least that's the attempt.
Too short.
Exactly. And then it's, you know, is it work that I think is unique or important? And I have my catalog is, it's pretty big tent, you know, there's a wide range. And it was similar in my gallery. I had a really, I like a lot of different types of work. So, you know, my art collection is as diverse as my gallery catalog, you know, roster was, and my publishing catalog. So to me, there's a lot of factors that go into that piece. You know, do I think the work is interesting? Do I think it's something that I haven't necessarily seen before, or I haven't seen it done in a certain way, or I have an idea for a way we can present it in book form that would be really unique and kind of elevate it as an object. And then the financials have to make some sort of sense. So, you know, can we do crowdfunding? Does this person have collectors that are, you know, can we do a portfolio sale situation? Do they have grant funding? Because again, at the end of the day, I'm just, you know, it's my really expensive full-time hobby. Yeah. You know, I have a full-time job that allows me to have a full-time other job that doesn't, you know, pay any money and hopefully doesn't lose too much. And so what I ultimately realized recently too is that for me, I need to get something personally out of it. You know, I'm putting a ton of my time and energy and basically, you know, all of my free time. And if I loved playing golf, I wouldn't play anymore if I wasn't getting something out of it, mm-hmm. right? You know, it's not just about like, oh, I want to make sure that this golf course stays in business and, you know, that my caddy, is that the person that holds
the
clubs?
Yeah,
like has a job. You know, like I need to enjoy it too. So I realized that for me personally, the books that I get the most out of are ones that I really feel like I learned something from, whether it's, you know, a really like conceptually deep project that is pulling me in and giving me a perspective on something that I didn't think about before, and that I can, by publishing it, I'm really getting involved in a much deeper way. If I have an opportunity to work on the edit and sequence and design, especially if it's a little bit unique, you know, that's another way. If I have an opportunity to, you know, sometimes I co-publish with other publishers, or I use designers that are outside of my normal, you know, network. And so I get pulled in those conversations, and I learn a lot through that. So to me, I recently was like, that really needs to be a huge component, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and what you're saying about just the value of these relationships is, you know, some of these artists are really, really close friends too.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think it's, you know, it's great to work with friends whose work you love. It can, you know, there are certainly pitfalls, like, you know, it sucks to talk money with friends as well. But I think over, you know, just over time, this sort of mutual understanding that we have makes, ultimately just makes the book as good as it can be, you know, mm-hmm. one thing. And no one wants to have the opportunity to make a book that is sort of just, you know, what we would think of as a kind of like a traditional exhibition catalog or something. I mean, there,
absolutely, yeah.
There are so many more ideas that the artist can bring into every facet of the book, from, you know, the text contributors, if that is a thing in one of these books, mm-hmm. the design and the production, that you know, there's just that level of collaboration is so important on the artistic level, and then it just makes a better book. You know, those
absolutely. Really, and if they're not going to collaborate, then they may as well self-publish.
Yeah,
because they're not, you know, bringing your expertise. You know, they're not open to other ideas. Then, you know, what's the point in collaborating with a publisher?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Excellent point. You know, something else about the question you asked about the changing landscape, and again, it's kind of I'm curious about your response to this too, is sort of like, you know, wasn't there kind of like a golden era of the portfolio review, you know? And
yeah,
you know, like I met you in Boston, and you know,
yeah,
so for a while there I was like Santa Fe, Portland, Houston, like there were, you know, and then it seemed like there were even more, and there again was it kind of, you know, diffusing a little bit in terms of,
absolutely, you know, I think
the effects of that, and it felt more pay to play over time. And
yeah, I think that's a really great analogy to the publishing thing too. So yes, it's kind of like back in the day, in the golden, you know, era of portfolio reviews, there were these couple of, you know, there was Santa Fe, mm-hmm. which is like, you know, Steidl, or you know, like, yeah. You had these reviews, and they were hard to get into, and they meant something, and the reviewers were able to give real opportunities. And then, yeah, it's like just more and more photo festivals were popping up around the country, and they all had portfolio reviews, and every like art center was doing a portfolio review. And yeah, I think for me, I stopped doing them for probably 4 or 5 years, because I was just seeing the same work over and over, mm-hmm. and I was seeing, and the people that could really afford to go to them tended to be, I don't mean this to sound disparaging in any way, but like, you know, a retired dentist who found photography like later in life and was photographing floral arrangements, or, you know, which were lovely, but not the kind of work that I was getting benefit from connecting with. So
yeah,
I love giving feedback on work, any type of work at any level. But in terms of, was it worth my time as a publisher to go, you know, I wasn't finding book projects from doing it. So it was more like a community right. service, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. That all
thing sounds, instead of a measure. Yeah.
That all sounds very familiar, you know. And there was, you know, there was great work, but it did sort of, you know, the character changed over time. And, you know, I'm wondering if the pandemic just blew a hole in that industry too.
Well, now, so part of it too was, for me personally, you know, I have a full-time job. Mm-hmm. So I was like, am I going to use my vacation days and my full-time job to go work for free at a portfolio review?
Mm-hmm.
No. And for free, like, okay, you will give me a flight and a hotel, and then I need to work for you for 8 hours a day while I'm there. So that also didn't make any sense. But with the pandemic, a ton of these reviews have gone online.
Yeah.
And so, and I was participating, I participated in several of those, and it was interesting. I mean, you know, there's not like the super awesome camaraderie and hanging out at the hotel bar at the end of the, you know, like you're not meeting the other reviewers except in the like combined Zoom room, you know, on the screen. Right. So weird.
Yeah.
But it was an interesting way to kind of feed that, the piece for me that I do enjoy of like giving photographers feedback. But yeah, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, I've done a few virtual ones, like, you know, ICP, and there's a, there is a value in a sense, or a kind of like, you know, modernizing upgrade to a virtual portfolio review, in that, like, you know, over time, I mean, for me, I'm not a gallerist, so I don't need, I don't need to
see
being the prints, but the whole white glove treatment, you know, literally is not always the kind of like right approach when we were in a sort of, you know, fairly rapid fire sort of
text,
right? And I think we're also used, I mean, you know, this is still why books are so great, like staring at your screens the whole time and seeing an image like that is obviously really different to the, you know, physical translation of a printed book. But, you know, we're used to it. We can do it. We can do it in an edit context. We can do it in a review context. So, you know, that's nice. But certainly the kind of, I mean, obviously, like the social factor, as you described, was great. And, you know, there were good panels and stuff. But
But I do think
tenants didn't seem like they necessarily, I don't know if they all hold up today. Right.
Yeah. And I agree. And I think too, like in the online portfolio reviews, they become more accessible again. Mm-hmm. So for the photographer, because you have to pay to participate in the review, period, you know, like however many hundreds of dollars. But normally they would also have to fly to a place and pay for a hotel and print out their portfolio and bring, you know, and create some sort of clever leave behind to give to, you know, so that at the end I had a bag full of
heavy bag.
And so if you strip away all of those expenses, it does make it a lot more accessible. And so I did feel like I was seeing more interesting work. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually, you know, I'm publishing someone who lives in Poland, who I met from a portfolio review that would never have been able to fly to the US to sit down for 20 minutes at a time with reviewers. Yeah, so, so yeah, there are some really good benefits from it, I think.
So, I mean, some of this question is, you know, finding the people on the projects that we publish, right? And I think, you know, some of that for me, the project has been a little bit one of visibility and, you know, not just making a book that like gets a lot of media or sells a lot or something. I mean, we were very fortunate this year to public, I finally got to work with Sig Harvey, as you know, and, you know, someone who I think I met, if I'm not mistaken, in Santa Fe, and was just immediately taken with her work. And, you know, she published her first few books with Schilt in the Netherlands, and great books. And, you know, when I was finally in a position at Monticelli to start doing photography books again, starting, you know, not starting with, but again, reuniting with Eleanor to publish the Midlife book, and, you know, really very proud to have had the opportunity to do that, because it's really important work. And I think really resounded with an audience. And, you know, ironically enough, that body of work was not that easy for her to, get attention for in terms of a book proposal from other publishers. And I was finally like, why don't we just do this? You know?
And the press for that book was insane.
I think that, you know, the kind of like complete validation of her thesis of sustained, you know, self-exploration and just, you know, kind of grappling with the kind of, you know, the day-to-day and the metaphysics of this stage in people's life. And certainly in my life, we're, I don't know if you know this, Eleanor and I are day apart in age. So we always
have. Oh, that's so good. You're like, I feel
the,
you.
The shared journey, you know?
But you were saying Sig Harvey.
Yeah, getting but then, a chance, you know, just kind of like the visibility that I was talking about is the kind of like, and, you know, this was something of the project, you know, years ago at Chronicle, is kind of like building a list that, again, as you're saying, is diverse, but you know, has a viewpoint, and you know, in a sense, who the idealized audience is for you know, for these books, and you make the books in a certain way that that do resonate. And so, to be able to have a nice, again, Sig has a following that is really strong, and
it's,
you know, doing Blue Violet was such a pleasure.
And Sig has a following that is like manic.
Mm-hmm.
The people love Sig.
Completely.
I do too.
Yeah.
I mean, that I did a podcast with her. It's got like twice as many listens as like any other, you know, as like the second highest one. And yeah, the triptych sold out right away. And I was like,
so great.
I'm just going to change my whole business model to be like, I'm only publishing Sig Harvey books. And she is a fucking delight.
Yeah.
She is just sunshine. Oh, it's amazing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so, you know, just to slowly build a list that, you know, consists of Eleanor and Jonah Frank and Sig Harvey and, we'll just see where that goes. And also in, you know, this is particular to my taste as well, but, you know, always, I work on a lot of architecture books. I love architectural photography, like, you know, and land art. And we just had this lovely catalog co-published with the Nevada Museum of Art, coinciding with their exhibition by Gianfranco Gorgoni, land art photographs. And,
oh, wow.
You know, completely different scale than everything that we're talking in terms of,
these,
obviously more like, you know, rooted day-to-day observational, intimate photographers. But I also love that stuff too. It's just, you know,
it seems like Monticelli is where like you have that range.
We have the, you know, this is the, if I don't want to say, you know, underdog is kind of a stupid word, but you know, when you are in a position where everyone is, you know, trying to figure out why we're doing what we're doing and how we do it, you have a lot of opportunity there. I mean, we're a nearly 30-year-old company that people think of as mainly an architecture publisher, but if you look at the, there's a lot of diversity in the list too. And, you know, we're not one of like the huge publishers. So we have opportunities to do these books with personality. And then the task is always to find the ways that they can connect with the audience. So selling is always the trick too.
Yeah. That's the bummer part.
You know, but like you're saying, it's like the books themselves, the artists, you know, that there's substance, there are ideas, they're well produced, they're design forward, and they have a kind of, you know, aura around them that people want to get close to. I mean it's starting to get a little metaphysical, I get it, but you know, there's that kind of transformation of these static images to kind of, you know, physical object that really, you know, it's a process that's amazing to participate in. And I think consumers, audience, you know, feel that integrity when they get to these books. So I just want to keep trying to, you know, make them right in that sense.
I remember, and I believe this is correct, you have a tattoo on your wedding finger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it's like a ring.
Yeah.
Tattooed on your finger. And I've thought about that for years.
Yeah.
And how ballsy that is. And awesome. Like the conviction of not only getting married, but getting it tattooed, and have been so pleased that the marriage is working out, presumably.
Well,
But I mean, I was married when we met. I got divorced. Mm-hmm. I was thinking, I'm so glad I don't have a tattoo mm-hmm. on my finger.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But, no, I think
that. But I also think I knew ahead of time that wouldn't be the best idea.
Well, I mean, that makes sense. And, you know, it's certainly a commitment. Even more than the one you're supposed to be making in the, you know, act of getting married, right? But that's supposed to be a lifelong thing. And I think we knew when we met that this is going to be it. And of course, life happens, and you know, there's ups and downs, and we have a 9-year-old and everything. But the I never have second thoughts on this ring. I think we're needing to kind of get it enhanced because next year is the 20th anniversary.
Wow.
Yeah. So, no, Jen sends her best as well. And I hope we can all
tell her I said hi. Oh, I know. I'm hoping to get to New York soon. It's been a year and a half.
Oh yeah, of course. I hope we can.
Yeah.
But, I think, you know, if we split, that would be the thing you got to do is chop off the finger. That's the only way. That's the only way to
lose the wife, lose the finger. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense to me.